Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm joined by Reason Magazine Editor-in-Chief Catherine Mangu Ward and Features Editor Peter Suderman. We're going to talk about the French election, the Republican health care bill that just passed the House of Representatives, and the brouhaha over Stephen Colbert saying that Donald Trump's mouth is only good as a cock holster for Vladimir Putin. Catherine, Peter, thanks for talking.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's get right to it. Catherine, in the French election, the centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron won with 66% of the vote. About 10% of voters filed blank ballots, which is understood as a sign of disapproval or kind of opting out. Macron is the consummate centrist politician. He started a kind of fake political party about a year ago that mostly exists online. He is right in the mainstream of most French economic policy, although he's also pledged to do labor market reform. What is the significance of a Macron victory for the EU, for the for the supposed wave of populism that's sweeping the globe? And does it matter to the U.S. one way or the other, really?
We're sort of in this odd moment where an utterly bland, generic centrist candidate has won office and everyone is like, oh, my God, this is a huge deal. I think everyone had sort of, after the Trump victory and after Brexit, had braced for this to become the trend of three. And because even in our increasingly secular world, we are still superstitious creatures, that third thing seemed like it was going to be a confirmation of the trend. Now it's just two weird things and normal behavior. I do like those 10% of ballots, though, that are blank. It's such a very, very French thing. It's like it's like the voting equivalent of going like, with the shrug and the kind of, it's like it seems quite culturally well suited. And I do think, of course, going forward, candidates would do well to pay attention to those 10%.
The French voter, like Camus, Sisyphus, must vote, but they vote for nobody. I kind of like that too. Peter, do you have a strong sense of like, will this stop? I mean, I guess on a certain level, will it stop the conversation about the inevitability of populism and localism taking over the globe?
So I don't think it will stop the conversation. I do think it is notable that Macron, or however we're supposed to pronounce it, ran on an upstart party, and that his election is it represents a couple of things. One is a kind of a rejection of Le Penism and an acceptance of France in the in the EU. It is he ran the thing that this is most clearly is a mandate for more Europe from France following the Brexit vote, but it is also a rejection of the party system that has dominated in France for decades. And that is pretty interesting to me. And it is especially interesting since, in terms of economic policy, Macron ran on a lot of labor reforms. Now, he's a big booster of the entitlement state and wants to sort of shore up the French safety net programs. But he's also somebody who has been somewhat critical, especially sort of for a French politician, of the labor market, of the unions, which have an awful lot of power in France, of a lot of the labor market rules there. And so he's an interesting character. I don't know if he quite has the strength of personality to really beat back the rising tide of populism in the country. And it's possible that his kind of technocratic centrism will end up, sort of giving that movement some steam going forward. Mm-hmm. But he is someone who is kind of an interesting guy, it will be very much worth watching what he is able to do after the legislative vote.
Right. Yeah. Which is obviously in many ways is far more important because that's when the real power kind of gets divvied up in a lot of ways. One of the things that
he's not going to be able to govern well unless he can win support in the legislature.
Which will be interesting to see if he can pull that off. One of the things I find interesting about Marine Le Pen is that she is really very what we would consider progressive in terms of most economic policy, state entitlements. One of the reasons she dislikes immigrants is she thinks it's going to destroy the labor economy for French people, for, you know, what she considers real French people. She wants entitlements to stay where they are. She supported the 35-hour work week, which Macron has talked about as problematic. So it's kind of fascinating to me that when you look at French politics, obviously nobody comes close to what even a Republican Party rhetoric would be. But there are significant differences and weird overlaps with the American left. Catherine, do you see any reason to think that Le Pen's nationalism and kind of xenophobia, will that ever migrate into the Democratic Party or to the progressive wing of things in an American context? Or are we just coming at it from a very different perspective?
I think the clumping of ideologies there has much more to do with the history of politics in the two countries. I mean, there simply isn't the thread of limited government ideology in France in the way that there is here. Not to say it doesn't exist, but it's much weaker and it's much less central, I think, to the bigger ideas that people are dealing with there. There's also, you know, what this is essentially a study in the fact that those two ideas, the idea of some kind of cultural conservatism and also the idea that the state should be smaller, that the welfare state is pernicious, don't naturally go together. And that's something that I think Americans often believe and are looking for in Donald Trump, even though he also is not a limited government ideologue by any stretch of the imagination. The necessary pairing of those ideas is disproven by Le Pen. In the U.S., it's a historical artifact. And, of course, I would like to see more politicians coming down on the side of limited government and fewer on the side of cultural conservatism. But I usually don't get my way.
Yeah. Well, that's life for you. Peter, you know, besides the fact that he wants companies to be able to decide their labor market policies rather than unions at the industry-wide level, and a couple of other feints towards the, you know, what I think most people would consider centrist economic policies, the most interesting thing about Macron is that his wife used to be his high school teacher and is 25 years older than him, so this injects a kind of fascinating, you know, France doesn't have an official role for a first lady, but François Hollande, the outgoing president, had a problem with the ladies, and of course the guy before him, Sarkozy, Nicolas Sarkozy, was married multiple times, most recently to Carla Bruni, international kind of groupie and songstress. Can we learn something from Macron and being in a kind of Mary Kay Letourneau situation?
I mean, I suspect that this is all, you know, quite tabloid ready, and that it will provide a lot of fodder for the sort of reality TV aspect of French politics. And frankly, I think that that is how people are going to interact with national political narratives quite a bit more going forward. And you see that with the Trump administration. You started to see it even under the Obama administration in a different way, is that people treat national politics as a kind of national, you know, a story about your country that is being presented basically like a reality TV show.
I wonder what the implications, and obviously in French culture, it's going to be very different than in American contexts. But, you know, Ivanka Trump has been, you know, she's effectively kind of acting as first lady in the sense that she seems to, in a way that Michelle Obama or Hillary Clinton had the ear of their presidents, Ivanka is seen as a shadowy figure in the Trump administration. Catherine,
she's not that shadowy. She's got an office in the White House now.
Yeah, but nobody knows what
official title, the whole thing.
Nobody knows what her portfolio quite is or what kind of effect she's having on Trump. But I agree. I mean, it's you know, this also goes back to, you know, these are like the myth of the hero with a thousand faces or the Fisher King, that somehow, you know, the inner life of the ruler of a land, you know, the status of that and the health of that means we either have feast or famine. Catherine, would you join me, and I suspect that you would, in calling for an end to all ceremonial offices like the First Lady? Isn't it just or the first spouse, which we'll, I'm sure, see sometime in our lifetimes. But aren't these awful institutions that we should just stop altogether?
Already, I like to think that Reason Magazine is doing its part on this front. We don't capitalize First Lady. It's our house style to say this is just basically some gal that wandered into the White House and she can do whatever she wants, but she certainly doesn't get a capital letter. So right there, we've struck a blow for the people rather than the powerful.
Yep. I just want to make sure that when it's the first dude that, you know, if it was Todd Palin, we wouldn't be capitalizing first husband or anything.
Right. No, definitely
I'm going to disagree here real quick. Throw out a possible disagreement. Like, the anarchist in me wants to make all offices ceremonial.
Okay.
It is true, in fact.
We don't want to outlaw them. We want all of the offices to be...
The first lady, let's abolish the presidency. We'll keep the first lady. It's pure bully pulpit, nothing else. Done.
And also then in Congress, only the sergeant at arms, he gets to carry a piece and that's it.
And the pages. You know, like we'll keep the pages because they have those nice blazers.
And you have to, because somebody has to be able to do the Capitol tour to see the sergeant at arms.
Yeah, the pages were never on the table. They're just not part of this deal.
I'm fine with my tax dollars going to this.
We have probably exhausted the French election more than the French election exhausted the French people. So let's talk about the American Health Care Act. Peter, you have a piece in the New York Times, in the Sunday New York Times, about the AHCA, which is the bill that just passed the Republican controlled House of Representatives. What is your piece about? What's your take on this supposed repeal and replace bill for Obamacare?
So the argument I make in the piece is that the bill itself doesn't really make very much sense as healthcare policy. As a lot of folks have said, it kind of retains the core ideas of Obamacare, you know, regulations. It keeps Obamacare's key insurance regulations in place at the federal level and lets states choose to apply for a waiver to opt out if they want. It's not even clear if many, if any, states would go for that at all. And then it sort of institutes a different system of subsidies dispersed through the tax code. And instead of an individual mandate, there is a penalty assessed by insurance companies on people who go without coverage when they re-enter the market. The whole the scheme of this thing is just a mess, and it is quite likely to lead to insurance market meltdown even faster than what we're seeing with Obamacare, with insurers kind of being wary of the exchanges, pulling back their activity, and with a lot of states only having basically one insurer throughout the state or throughout much of the state. And so it just doesn't make much sense as health care policy, which is why the better way to think of it is as tax policy, as a tax bill, and as, in particular, as a setup for the tax reform that congressional Republicans and Donald Trump have talked about doing later in the year. And this is something that I'm not sort of imagining this. This is something that Republicans have said repeatedly. In fact, if you go and watch the Rose Garden ceremony that House Republicans held with President Trump a few hours after passing the American Health Care Act last week, there was one Republican representative, Kevin Brady, who said something to the effect of, this was a really big step towards tax reform. President Trump used a big portion of his remarks to talk about how he was going to do the biggest tax cut in American history, and this was a big help getting towards that. And so,
how does this advance tax reform?
The short version is that by eliminating the taxes in Obamacare, what it does is it allows Republicans to get to the lower rates. And this is the big thing for Republicans. They're always looking for lower income tax rates and to sort of lower rates all around, because you're working within the context of a revenue neutral bill. And so what Republicans are really doing here is passing healthcare policy that I think is really fundamentally flawed, because they're not concerned about the healthcare policy. And the argument I make at the end of the piece is that the healthcare policy is so flawed that in the long run, it is likely to lead to bad tax policy, because when the exchanges melt down, when we see the disruption of coverage for millions of people without something, clearly better to take its place fairly quickly, then what we are going to see is that creates an opportunity, it creates energy towards more government intervention in the market. And that's exactly what I think we don't need in healthcare. I think we need smarter, clearer, simpler rules. I think, as I have said on other recent podcasts, I think the whole system is a mess. I think that neither Obamacare nor the American Healthcare Act really take, you know, do a very good job of fixing that mess. And Republicans just sort of have this bad habit of treating all policy, at least all domestic policy, like tax policy, and making all other policy, sort of basically ignoring the rest of the policy universe. Everything is there to serve tax policy, and in particular, just tax cuts. And that's why we have the deficit, the debt problems that we have, because they don't think about spending, they don't think about welfare entitlement programs. In any case, I think it's a mess of a bill, and I think Republicans are not really thinking well about what they're doing.
Just to make sure I understand, essentially by repealing the taxes that fund Obamacare subsidies, that lowers the amount of revenue that the Republicans have to generate in their tax bill in order for it to be revenue neutral.
And that allows them to get to, with a lower, in a revenue neutral scenario, the lower the amount of revenue that you have to raise, the lower the rates that you need to get there. And that's what Republicans are going for. That's why they did the healthcare bill first, even though there's some reporting that suggests that Donald Trump kind of wanted to do infrastructure and tax reform first. But they had to do this sort of, they had to use, you know, the process here. To go ahead and do this before getting to tax reform.
Catherine, do you take your kids to the doctor, or do you just practice transcendental meditation to keep your kids healthy?
I just let them sleep outside in the cold because I heard that makes children hardy. No, I mean, I think
that's what we evolved for, right?
That's right.
You know, I mean, who are we to question evolution?
That's right. No, I mean, I think, you know, obviously Peter's analysis here is subtle and sophisticated and on point. And I just want to note that instead of talking about that stuff, what we spent all of last week talking about was whether or not rape is a pre-existing condition in Trump's America. This was a great piece that Elizabeth Nolan Brown did at Reason.com last week. And, you know, this idea that the way that we now talk about even our sort of fairly nitty gritty healthcare reform bills is immediately just shout the word rape at each other over and over. It suggests that no one is really very well equipped to think in a serious way about
least,
these bills.
At least we're talking. At least we're talking, you know. Where there's talk, there's hope.
And in fact, I think, you know, this is an important point to make, that all across the board, lots of people wrote these headlines. They were typically quite uniform and essentially said if you had been raped, you probably weren't eligible for health insurance, or strongly implied it under the reformed healthcare bill. That's simply not true. And in fact, is really just touching on a fundamental bureaucratic point that by voiding out some of the requirements at the federal level for covering certain pre-existing conditions, there was a theoretical possibility in what turned out to be two states that don't have state-level laws already prohibiting this behavior, that you could, if you were prescribed anti-HIV medication as a precaution after being raped, theoretically be denied some coverage for HIV later if you had it, which is not the same thing.
That's not as good a headline.
That's not as good a headline.
It's just not as good a headline. I can't fit that into a tweet.
Yeah, Cosmo can't tweet that.
Yeah, I went to a publishing course once, and the guy said he was John Mac Carter, who was a legend in the magazine business. This was about 20 years ago. And he said the best – nobody knows why news magazine covers work or not to sell copies, but the best bets are you have a number on it, like a list of the 10 best something, a Christmas tree, and the word orgasm. So, yeah, you know, the headline that you just put out there, Catherine, really fails on all of those.
Sorry, my bad.
But, you know, to go to this larger point about the discussion, and, you know, it seemed to be a clearly coordinated effort. And I don't know if it was self-organizing or whatnot, but, you know, you saw that rape is now a pre-existing condition. That phrase, that headline, that talking point, I mean, suddenly it went from you know, that was everywhere. You know, and I guess there's a couple things to say about that. One is that, you know, Catherine, to the large point that this is just bullshit, that it's absolutely not true. That's disturbing that, you know, even in, you know, kind of vaguely sober outlets, we're willing to go with that. But then also the speed with and the kind of ubiquity and uniformity that it showed up. I mean, it's disturbing when we're talking about actual policy, you know, details, and people don't give a shit. And, you know, it's both on the right and the left. You know, in a way, this is not all that different than the death panels talk, the way that that kind of metastasized from a throwaway line to, you know, to a hard and fast reality. Is there a way out of this, especially, you know, we're more polarized than ever. Everybody hates Donald Trump who hates him. Everybody loves Donald Trump who loves him. You know, what is a path forward that won't drive all of us insane who at least try to come up with rational, reality-based policy analysis and discussion of politics, culture, and ideas?
One path forward is the incredibly unsexy thing that some of the guys we hate the least in Congress are constantly advocating for, which is if there was a bill that was written and then circulated widely among both legislators and commentators, we wouldn't wind up with this sort of panicked rumor mill about what's in the bill. Now, in this case, the fact that pre-existing conditions were probably that the coverage for those was going to be altered was known. So this is not precisely on that point. But the idea that people, very broadly speaking, simply didn't know that the word rape was nowhere in the bill because the bill wasn't hanging around for very long is part of it. Also, you know, I think the simpler point that when we get ourselves into these incredibly elaborate schemes like Obamacare, which is a sort of complex, multi-part rejiggering of a rejiggering of a rejiggering, you know, even when the bill is available, sometimes, you know, the plain text does not tell us how it will actually perform in the real world.
I mean, this is another thing to note about the American Healthcare Act, the Republican bill, is that Republicans spent years complaining that that Obamacare was passed by Democrats who hadn't read the bill and rammed it down their throats. And then on Thursday, last week, you had Republicans saying, well, I didn't read the bill. I'm not sure anybody actually read the whole bill. This bill was shorter than Obamacare. They passed it faster. They didn't even wait for the Congressional Budget Office to score the most recent version. Speaker Ryan's press office has been saying, well, of course, there was a Congressional Budget Office score. It's true that there was one of an earlier version of the bill, but that version of the bill couldn't pass. They tried to hold a vote and didn't because they didn't have enough votes. And so there were crucial changes, in particular the state opt-out, which it's going to be really interesting to find out whenever CBO does release this score, which has to be done before the bill gets taken up in the Senate. It's going to be really interesting to sort of see what CBO thinks of that amendment to the bill.
Yeah,
and how many states may or may not take them up on opt-out provisions.
And the almost perfect mirror of Paul Ryan, you know, Speaker Paul Ryan acting like Speaker Nancy Pelosi, you know, kind of waving away an insistence that legislators actually read the bill or understand what's in it, or that there's a process in place that is specifically designed to not necessarily slow down legislation, but to give meaningful information like a CBO score. It's, you know, that it, I find it deeply offensive, not because it's the Republicans doing it and I expect better from them, but it's so awful. I mean, it's similar to the whole discussion that we've had about the nuclear option where, you know, first it's a Republican, then it's a Democratic feint, you know, a ploy, et cetera. To bring it back to the Macron story, you know, Macron had some emails that were hacked and were released. Obviously, it didn't undermine his candidacy the way that emails that had to do with Hillary Clinton hurt, you know, almost certainly hurt her and the Democratic National Party. We accept such a low level of seriousness from our politicians in many ways that it just drives me nuts. And I keep saying with the hacks of Hillary emails and Podesta emails and DNC emails, like if those emails had generally, even if they had some sexy, you know, kind of gossip in it, if they had revealed that Hillary Clinton was actually pretty honest in her dealings and that the DNC wasn't trying to obviously screw over Bernie Sanders from the beginning, they saw him as the threat, they were trying to take him out, it wouldn't matter. Like, but I get the idea that politicians in an age of forced transparency, and even, you know, the AHCA passage isn't transparency per se, but I mean, it's not coming out of a hack, but like they don't get, like, if they actually behaved properly, people would have more faith in them and in the process, and we would probably have a higher level of discussion because people wouldn't realize that it's all just about partisan politics and like fucking over somebody on a near-term vote that has nothing to do with principle. Catherine, do you think that's at all a plausible reading of a way to get back to or get forward to, you know, a political discourse that isn't so ridiculous that, you know, rape is a pre-existing condition?
You know, I think I certainly have the temptation to like stand up somewhere and shout like, everyone calm down and let's talk like grownups. And that's clearly not going to happen. And I suppose, you know, you can argue that when we're basically looking at headlines about rape and Stephen Colbert jokes about, you know, whose mouth is or isn't a cock holster, maybe that we've just gone too far and we should lean all the way into satire. I'm open to that option, too. So maybe let's just go full ridiculous.
I mean, to bring this back to France, right? This is where you saw the major parties rejected. This is not just an American phenomenon, right? And there's a reason that people are seem extremely frustrated with political leadership in the West, and it's in America and it's elsewhere, and that's, you know, Brexit and Donald Trump and even Macron, despite being a kind of an embrace of more Europe, represents that with his, you know, his startup party, his the fact that this is a guy who has never run for office before. He was a government minister, but you know, it's really sort of interesting and notable how much frustration there is. I think much of it really quite legitimate with global political leadership.
Yeah, it's almost, you know, I guess in a way, and not to necessarily give credence to anti-WTO protests starting in the late 20th century, but the way that, you know, people at Davos, kind of business leaders, seemed out of touch with the regular economy, and there were protests against that. It's finally, you know, Matt Welch and I in the Declaration of Independence talked about how politics is a lagging indicator. And it's true, I think, in a lot of our commercial institutions and religious institutions, et cetera, you saw people lose faith within, you know, the past couple of decades. And those institutions have come back in various ways, if they're still around, to kind of placate customers or rebuild trust. And you can even look at a lot of aspects of the sharing economy or the new economy, I guess it used to be called at various points, which are about kind of creating transparency or a sense for customers that they're getting a good deal, you know, and you have reputational value, et cetera. And maybe that's going to be coming to politics soon. To go to this question of politicization of everything, one of the big stories last week was Stephen Colbert, the late night host, gave a rant, comic rant about Donald Trump, where among the lines, and it was bleeped when it actually aired on CBS in late night, sometime after 11 o'clock. But he said that Trump's mouth is only good to be a cock holster for Vladimir Putin. Beyond the fact that whether or not that joke is funny, it does show a kind of willingness. I mean, this is not the type of thing that you would have seen on TV 20 or 30 years ago, for sure. Obviously, fewer people watch late night in real time than ever before. The story coming out of this is somebody complained to the FCC, so they have to investigate the complaint. This goes to a kind of bad reporting element where the FCC by statute has to examine or investigate complaints filed to it. So it's not anything different. They look at all kinds of complaints. But two questions for this. First is, you know, Does Stephen Colbert, who's very funny, but that's a joke that is like not particularly funny, but it does show that kind of exasperation from a liberal. He was very much in favor of a kind of Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders kind of candidacy. Is it simply showing the exasperation that the that liberals have with the Trump presidency? But does it also show an inability of American culture to really do anything other than harden into these kind of really negative, polarized positions that don't, you know, that don't get us anywhere.
I actually thought it was interesting that the complaints about that particular joke fell into two categories. So there were the people who said, okay, it's obscene. It violates the indecency standard. Then there were other people who said, oh, well, no, the problem with the joke is it's homophobic. Our metric for offense is no longer some kind of, list of words or a desire not to profane a deity, but instead that the worst thing you can do now is to suggest that there might be something bad about using anyone's mouth in that way, I guess. And I think that actually, more than the, let's use the apparatus of the FCC to complain about our political enemies. The fact that even the debate over what was wrong with that not great joke would be having, so bifurcated. So yeah.
Having said, you're right. But is there any reason to believe that the people who were attacking Stephen Colbert for being homophobic, and this is a guy who in Strangers with Candy, he played a parodic secretly gay high school teacher. He was part of the sexually ambiguous duo, running skit on Saturday Night Live. He is certainly no enemy of gay and lesbian equality under the law in terms of marriage. Is it just concern trolling from the right?
I think it's concern trolling both directions, right? Like it will neither somehow like violate the innocence of America's young children that somebody said the word cock on TV late at night, nor is it actually real evidence of homophobia. It's concern trolling both ways. And the FCC is the perfect tool to use to amplify your concern trolling to the nth degree.
That much is sure. Yeah, the FCC. And, it's always funny for my kids who are 23 and 15, they have no idea. They grew up in a post-broadcast world where there's this distinction that is, still made by law between content that goes out over the so-called public airwaves and stuff that goes on cable, because it's all just, it shows up on a screen for them, and they have no fucking idea where it's coming from, nor should they. Peter, the FCC is almost certainly not going to take any action against this. One would think that Ajit Pai, Trump's deregulatory-minded, free speech-minded FCC commissioner, I can't imagine that he's really going to, this is going to go very far with him. But is this just more evidence that, as Catherine was saying, the FCC is like the ultimate concern troll agency? But should we just be getting rid of these distinctions between broadcast media and other forms of media, which are not technically governed by the FCC in terms of content regulation?
Yeah, I really don't think the FCC needs to be investigating any of this ever. And I think that that's just... If there was ever a reason for it, and I'm not sure there was, there certainly isn't now. And the FCC is a kind of national speech monitor for the media is just, is an idea that just has no purchase and no reason to exist in 2017 and hasn't for a long time.
Yeah. And, whether or not we get there, that'll be interesting because, and this also goes to, one of the things that I will say that I kind of like about Donald Trump is that, and this typically doesn't further libertarian goals whatsoever, but as Catherine was saying, that Trump doesn't quite fit. He's anti-immigrant, so he should be a Republican, but then he's got other things that are more kind of centrist or even liberal economic policies that he supports. With the FCC, I mean, it's fascinating to me that somebody like Ajit Pai is pretty good on First Amendment issues. And, he talks about that. We had an interview with him that recently went up at Reason.com. But then he's against he's getting rid of Title II regulation, and he's going to retract the Open Internet Order, which a lot of people on the left who claim to be in favor of free speech think is the worst thing that you could ever do. That we're going to lose so-called net neutrality and have a bunch of sites that will be randomly blocked by different ISPs or different things, or people will be able to buy fast lane access and thereby screw over the little guy. Peter, do you think there's any Is there any kind of teeth in that idea that we need to maintain net neutrality as it was promulgated in the waning days of the Obama administration?
I think net neutrality is a nice idea in principle, but it's not something that should be enforced at the federal level by the FCC. And, you know, Pai was against this during the Obama era when these rules were being debated and put in place. And he, you know, when the rules came down in 2015, he released this really fascinating 60-plus page dissent in which he sort of just tore apart the entire rationale for these rules. I mean, one of the things he notes early on in this dissent was that the target of the first net neutrality complaint from activists who were in favor of net neutrality was Metro PCS, a kind of upstart mobile data company, because Metro PCS had taken the steps of offering unlimited YouTube as part of their pricing plan. And so that's like that's the stuff that it actually sort of ends up getting regulated.
And that remains, that remains. Metro PCS was bought by T-Mobile, so they dropped their case, although Verizon continued to push a related case that forced a court ruling that went against the FCC as to whether or not they had the right to do that. But what you see again and again, and this is still the case with services like T-Mobile and other where they offer unlimited streaming of certain types of material that doesn't count against your monthly data cap. And it's, you know, it's kind of hard to see that where consumers lose out on that. But that's
right.
Right.
It's like, thank God we have a giant agency to protect us from free YouTube. And, you know, I get that there's a subtler critique, but still, fundamentally, that is what's going on. It's anti-competitive.
Longtime Reason contributor and a former FCC chief economist, Tom Hayslett, who has a fantastic book that's out this month in May called The Political Spectrum. And it's a history of the ways in which the FCC has allocated and misallocated and reallocated and just sat on bandwidth. And it might sound like a dry topic, but it's a phenomenal read of kind of economic history and policy history. But he says that net neutrality ultimately is about the government being able to dictate business models for people who provide access to to the internet and to telephony. And I think he's right. And Peter, to go back to, I mean, it's amazing to think about rules that were created essentially 100 years ago are still being used to talk about a world in which virtually nothing nothing that exists today existed back then or was even being thought of. It's one hopes that, this is another topic where we will at least be able to have a constructive conversation rather than simply saying, if you're for net neutrality, you're for a free and open internet where you can go online and you won't have to worry about Reason being blocked or choked down by your sinister cable company because they don't like libertarian politics, or that, I'm against net neutrality because I believe in freedom of speech and economic
rights. I think there's really a connection here between the Colbert stuff and net neutrality, which is that the Colbert, the complaints and the investigation there kind of come from an era 50 plus years ago when there were just three broadcast networks. And the net neutrality rules are basically deciding to regulate the internet using old style, decades old telephone regulations. And in both cases, it's totally outdated and it's the wrong approach. And it's just sort of, it's this like 20th century mindset that really makes for, I think, for really bad policy.
Yeah, and it's also even to the degree where FCC complaints are investigated on an individual basis, on a case-by-case basis, and that was part of the open internet order and the net neutrality rules that the Obama FCC promulgated, was that we're not even going to tell you exactly, we'll give you, here's the general ballpark, but then we're going to look at everything on a case-by-case basis, which is one of the ways that you freeze innovation or just kind of, tamp it down and throw some wet blankets on it. I would like to...
It's also about maximizing optionality for the existing players. So another thing that we're looking at for the next issue of the print magazine is an excerpt from that Thomas Hazlett book, and he describes how we could have had cell phones decades earlier than we did, except for the fact that the spectrum regulators kind of just wanted to keep as much spectrum as possible open for the thing that we knew already existed in the form that it already existed. And they were keeping an eye on sort of boogeyman hypotheticals that never manifested. And meanwhile, we all could have had gigantic, Motorola bricks to talk on the beach for, 22 minutes after a 10-hour charge, so much sooner. If only the FCC had gotten.
He has also written about how the rollout of cable was about 20 years after it was ready because of similar regulatory hijinks and capture by the National Association of Broadcasters of the relevant regulators. Well, let's close out by just talking. Peter, Catherine, thanks for talking. I think this idea of we're trying to govern the 21st century by 20th century rules is. I would like to think that that's at the root of almost all of the kind of what's being called populist or kind of opting out. This is eroding the faith in government because we are, like, whether it's in England, whether it's in Europe, whether it's in the United States or North America, it does seem like we have not yet started a 21st century model of governance in the same way that, say, use of computers, whether it's even something, an early version of it, like the way that Walmart used computers and real-time inventory control to revolutionize the way that they stocked their stores and they made prices cheaper in the late 20th century. It was kind of looking forward, but then places like Uber and Airbnb that allow people to access dead or underused assets. We need that in politics somehow. I'm not exactly sure what form it'll take, but it seems like until we get a 21st century set of government policies rather than going back to, holding on to a Bismarckian welfare state on the one hand and a mid-20th century regulatory model, this people are just going to get more and more pissed because this stuff isn't going to work very well. With that, we will conclude this episode of The Reason Podcast. This has been The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. My guests have been Catherine Mangu Ward, Editor-in-Chief of Reason Magazine. Catherine, thanks so much for joining me.
Merci.
And also features editor Peter Suderman. Check out his piece in the New York Times about the Republican healthcare bill and why it's not all that or a bag of chips. Peter, thanks for talking.
Chips are great, though.
Chips are great. And chips are a pre-existing condition, I think, pretty much for most of us. So we will leave it there. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening.